Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Our musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. And question number one, it was on this very day, back in which year, that the very first 45 RPM record was released? Was that A, 1933, B, 1949, C, 1956, or D, 1962? First 45, which year was that? And question number two, throughout the years, famous singers and bands have been tapped to perform at the Super Bowl. So, who was it that performed at Super Bowl 22 on this very day, back in 1988? Was that A, the Grateful Dead, B, Frank Sinatra, C, Dolly Parton, or D, Herb Alpert? Hint, Super Bowl 22 was played in San Diego on this day back in 1988. So who was that performer? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of January 31st. Well, it was on this day, back in 1797, that composer Franz Schubert was born. As noted in biography.com, Schubert is considered the last classical composer and the first romantic composer. His music is known for its melody and harmony. Schubert left behind more than 600 secular vocal works, 7 complete symphonies, sacred music, operas, incidental music, and a large body of piano and chamber music. And it was 56 years ago today, back in 1964, that the governor of Indiana declared that the song Louie Louie was pornographic. He therefore demanded that the state's radio stations not play this pornographic song. Turns out the FBI investigated the lyrics and found nothing objectionable, let alone intelligible, but the band served to skyrocket sales of that tune. Another name goes up in lights, like diamonds in the sky. And they'll tell you now you're the lucky one. Yeah, they'll tell you now you're the lucky one. But can you tell me now you're the lucky one? Oh, oh, oh. Taylor Swift's The Lucky One, from her 2012 album, Red, introduces our country music news. It's entitled The Best Songs of the Decade. This is published in Rolling Stone magazine, January 2020 edition. And coming in at number 5, All Too Well. That's Taylor Swift from this same album that's playing in the background now, Red, 2012. The devastating centerpiece of Red is about a relationship that's long over, except in Swift's memory, and in her ex's dresser, where he keeps a borrowed scarf he can't bring himself to return. The disappointment in her voice is still fresh as she thinks about the sweet-talking guy who turned to be so casually cruel in the name of being honest. She freestyle that line while sound checking for a concert. I was just playing these chords over and over on stage, and my band joined in, and I went on a rant. Tabloids quickly identified the scarf thief as Jake Gyllenhaal, but the brilliance of All Too Well is in how it makes you feel like you were right there with her, too.
2 years later, I showed up here.
Chris Botti's performance of Puccini's Nessun Dorma introduces our classical music news. As noted in OnThisDay.com, it was on this very day back in 1896 that Puccini's opera, Le Bohème, was first staged in Turin, Italy. So what is this famous opera about, anyway? As Aaron Green writes in a 4/3/19 article published in LiveAbout.com, the composer Giacomo Puccini created the opera Le Bohème in 1896, a four-act opera that premiered on February the 1st, 1896 in Turin, just a few years before composing Madama Butterfly, which is considered his most well-known work. The setting of Le Bohème takes place in 1830s Paris, France. The story shows vignettes of Bohemian youths who lived in the Latin Quarter of Paris and focuses on relationships, characters, and lovers. Rodolfo, the writer, falls in love with the seamstress Mimi, while Marcello, the painter, and Musetta, the singer, are an on-again, off-again couple by their sides. When the four are happy, they spend their time celebrating life and love. As elaborated by a ClassicFM.com article, it's a Christmas Eve in Paris. A young poet, an artist, and their landlord are celebrating in their flat. What could possibly go wrong? Well, over the course of a couple of hours, Puccini treats us to some of the most ravishing and famous opera arias in the world. The highlight for many, though, is the sumptuous Act I duet, O Lovely Maid in the Moonlight, a shimmering concoction of lush orchestration and enrapturing vocal melodies. Unsurprisingly, La Bohème doesn't end well. Marcello gets together with his old flame, Musetta, only then to discover that Mimi is dying. She passes away in Rodolfo's arms, and he is left utterly inconsolable. Romantic opera is never very cheerful, but in the hands of Puccini, it's always exquisitely beautiful. And by the way, the 1990s rock musical Rent by Jonathan Larson is loosely based on Puccini's opera La Bohème. Rent tells the story of 1 year in the life of friends living the bohemian life in East Village, New York City, 1989 to 1990.
Saturday night and we in the spot. Don't believe me, just watch.
Mark Ronson's Uptown Funk introduces our jazz, blues, and funk music news. It's entitled National Treasure. Make it funky. What was it about the Hammond organ that made the legendary James Brown say, please, please, please? This is published in Smithsonian Magazine, April 2018. James Brown always knew his measure. He thought very highly of his favorite person, James Brown, and was convinced that guy could do just about anything he set his mind to. Asked how he survived his earliest years when he was penniless and raised in a brothel, Brown explained, "I made it because I believed I'd make it." When asked why he still performed into retirement age, he explained to the interviewer, "I do it for the show. I do it for the feeling of humanity." Humanity needed the hardest working man in show business. Everything about him was big. Everything came in multiples. Brown boasted of the Learjets and furs and radio stations he owned. How in a year he would perform more than 600 hours on stage, play more than 960 songs on at least 8 instruments. And yet there was one thing that Brown didn't boast about, playing the Hammond B3 organ. He loved that thing, maybe because he never could quite own it. Brown traveled on the road with the instrument, today residing in the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, composed music with it, and smiled at the buzz it generated. It sounded raw and tender, damaged and from the heart, a sound embodied in the title he gave to a 1961 album featuring his organ playing, Grits and Soul. He bragged about what he could do on the stage, but he remained revealingly modest about what he was able to achieve on the keys. To a jazz writer, he confessed that he was not an organ player, that's for sure. What he tried to do was play from his spirit, he explained, because that's about all I can do. He went for feel, not mastery, but that's the way I express me. Around that time that Brown was born in the humid backwoods of South Carolina in 1933, an inventor in Evanston, Illinois, named Lorenz Hammond, was trying to create new sounds of his own. Hammond had already devised the first, now familiar, red and green 3D glasses for an early experiment in techno-enhanced music. Hammond followed that up with a bridge table that shuffled 4 decks of cards at a time. In the early 1930s, he was tearing up pianos, pondering how to get the big boom of a church organ while also making the instrument smaller and more affordable. The answer was to replace its reeds and pipes with an electric current. James Brown couldn't read music, and neither could Hammond. Both worked by feel and belief, and both clearly got intense when they sensed that they were onto something. Hammond debuted his first electric organ in 1935, and within 3 years he had sold more than 1,750 units to churches across America. It was perfect for African-American worshipers who were following the Great Migration up from the South, praying in enclaves without the means for a pipe organ. The Hammond electrified faith, and it electrified the faithful, too, because it had a way of projecting its fervor out onto the streets of America. People took the crazy feelings the Hammond unlocked and blasted them past the church into the rec room, the jazz club, the honky-tonk. A whole bunch of new feelings mixing sacred spaces and public places. Note the words on Brown's instrument, God-Father. As the announcer at the Howard and the Regal and the Apollo and the theaters everywhere else put it, Brown was, of course, the quote-unquote godfather of soul. But the wording on the black leather that handsomely wraps the instrument frames it a little differently and meaningfully. This instrument separates and balances the God and the Father, the sacred and the human. If God was in everyone, and if the Hammond was available to everyone, well, mastering it was still not easy. The Hammond permitted multiple pedals that multiplied your options, but Brown liked just one. He stayed on the one. He worshipped the early generations of jazz players who took the organ out of the church and into the chitlin spots and the smoky nightclubs, masters like Jimmy Smith, Jimmy McGriff, and Jack McDuff. He knew he wasn't them. The crowd made James Brown feel holy. The organ humbled him. It made him feel human. Maybe that's why he kept it close. like a secret. And in music research and technology, we have this article titled, Art and Music as Dementia Therapy. This is written by Trent Brown, published in News and Observer on the 26th of January, 2020. The visitors sit in folding chairs in front of a huge, ornately framed portrait of a man holding a gold staff against a blue and floral background. Maggie Griffin stands beside the artwork. St. John the Baptist II by Kehinde Wiley, the artist best known for painting President Barack Obama's official portrait. So I'm going to let you make some comments on what you're noticing, she says. What stands out when you see this particular piece? He's suspended in the air, says one man. His face is so pensive, not sad, but watchful, says a woman in the back. Griffin smiles and encourages each response with a genuine excitement. The program that has brought these 14 people and another 12 that split off earlier into the Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University this chilly January day is called Reflections. 11 of the 26 people in the two groups have Alzheimer's disease or another dementia-related illness. The others are their caretakers. Reflections adds interactive sensory components to an art gallery tour to help stimulate the brains of people with Alzheimer's, a specific disease that causes the loss of thinking skills and memory, and other forms of dementia. Nearly 6 million Americans have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, or 1 in 10 people ages 65 or older. Jessica Rule, the Nasher's education director, learned of the idea at a Museum of Modern Art conference in New York 8 or 9 years ago. Her grandfather was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Learn, support each other. The tours usually involve a group focusing on a few works of art while a tour guide asks them about it. The questions often begin at a surface level and lead into deeper questions about what memories the art triggers. It's really given me a new perspective on art, said Doug Taylor. I love it. Marion Gervais, who comes with her husband, Kenton Cobb, said they already had a membership to the Nasher, but called Reflections a wonderful immersion. The program also fosters community. People come to our programs initially having never met somebody else with dementia, says Bobby Machar, director of the Family Support Program. But here, through our programs, they get to be very open about their impairment and learn from each other and support each other. Harold Boast, who comes with his wife Shirley, who has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, said it's one of the most important parts of coming every month. It gives us an outing, he explained, and the more you can be with other people that have the same kind of issues that you do, you find you're not alone. Music as therapy. The recent tour's focus, after the Kehinde Wiley painting, turned to music. First, the group was given song lyrics from popular tracks like Lizzo's Truth Hurts or The Beatles' Yesterday and was told to match the lyrics to a piece of art in the room. Then the group looked at a large piece called Cats and Dogs, in which three vinyl records circle each other: Purple Rain by Prince, November Rain by Guns N' Roses, and Rain by the Beatles. Rule asked the visitors about their favorite albums and artists, and then if they could remember any specific memories about them. My sister gave me an album when I was 16, said one woman. The final part of the tour was the most interactive, changing sometimes between live music from Duke Orchestra performers to a DJ. Joseph Giampino stood behind his DJ table as the visitors came up to watch him perform to songs spanning the 1950s to the past decade, scrubbing a record back and forth to create a scratch sound. Giampino asked for a request, and Stephanie Kahn yelled out, "We want to dance!" And as soon as Good Golly Miss Molly by Little Richard started to play, folks started tapping their feet and playing invisible pianos. They were swaying, and they were tapping their hands and their feet to the music, Bobby Machar says, and these were people who were otherwise fairly blank during other parts of the program, but they really came alive with the music. Music is a well-studied form of therapy. According to the Alzheimer's Association, music can reduce agitation and improve behavioral issues in the middle stages of the disease, and can even help people in the late stages recall memories and lyrics from their childhoods. Other museums in the Triangle also have or are working on programs like Reflections. The NC Museum of Art has traveling trunks, which includes art reproductions and items one can see in the art to engage people with dementia. It also has tours that focus on the sense of touch and an American Sign Language introduction to the museum. UNC Chapel Hill's Ackland Art Museum is developing its own version of Reflections. As Giampino neared the end of his performance and the tour's end, he told the museum crowd that the DJs, because of their reactions, "It's making you move, it's making your feet stomp, it's making your head bob, and you feel it," Giampino said. "That's what music is, and that's what being a musician is, making people enjoy and giving them something." The data, by the way, of this Reflections Tours at the Nasher are the fourth Tuesday of every month. Admission is free, but reservations must be made at least a week in advance. So you can register at washer.duke.edu or call Jennifer Armstrong, Hicks, or email reflections@duke.edu. Adele's Rolling in the Deep introduces our rock and pop music news. It's from the article titled The Best Songs of the Decade, published in Rolling Stone, January 2020 issue. And coming in at number three, Rolling in the Deep by Adele, 2011. Freshly hurt by the end of her relationship with an older photographer, then 21-year-old Adele walked into producer Paul Epworth's Northwest London studio and made the greatest breakup song of the 2010s. "I never get angry, but I was ready to murder," she later recalled. "It's me saying, get the F out of my house," instead of me begging him to come back. You can hear it in her voice. An all-time performance whose roaring fury is downright biblical. Rolling in the Deep was a global chart topper that made Adele a superstar and proved that classic soul could still conquer the world. Carole King is the last person, before Adele, who wrote the kind of lyrics women immediately could relate to, marveled Aretha Franklin. "I love to hear a schoolgirl on the school bus yelling, we coulda had it all." How did you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this very day, back in which year, that the very first 45 RPM record was released. And the correct answer is Answer B, 1949. Texarkana Baby, Eddie Arnold, 1949, was the world's first commercially released 45 RPM record. And as noted in the History Dumpster website, recording technology had changed tremendously since Emil Berliner's first gramophone records in the 1890s, but very little had changed with the records themselves. They still rotated at 78 rotations per minute, RPM, but were still made of noisy shellac and extremely fragile. In 1948, Columbia Records unveiled the 33 and a third RPM long playing record. It played for about 20 minutes per side and made of thick and much quieter vinyl. The RCA 7-inch 45 RPM record was cute, very small, and RCA's very colorful vinyl. Each genre of music had its own color of vinyl, made it an instant hit with younger people. Popular releases were on standard black vinyl. Country releases were on green vinyl. Children's records were on yellow vinyl. And classical releases were on red vinyl, for example. This era in the turn of the 1950s was called the Battle of the Speeds. Some people like the 33 and the third LP, others like the 45, and the older folks loved the 78 RPM speed. The era of the 45s lasted 40 years before the cassette tape, CD, and MP3 player. 45s were the perfect portable personal music medium. But there's something about the 45 that an MP3 simply can't mimic. It's real, just the right size, something physical that you can hold. And the answer to our second question, throughout the years, famous singers and bands have been tapped to perform at the Super Bowl. So who performed at Super Bowl 22 on this very day back in 1988? Correct answer was answer D, Herb Alpert. According to liveabout.com, Alpert was co-founder of A&M Records. He combined Europop with Latin-flavored horns to create the hugely popular Tijuana sound. Known primarily as a great pop jazz trumpeter, Alpert's 1968 number one hit, This Guy's in Love with You, featured his vocals. And as the trivia question notes, he also performed at Super Bowl 22 in San Diego in 1988. So let's close out today's program with what the governor of Indiana 56 years ago today called pornography. Introduced by New York City DJ B. Mitchell Reed on a 1964 broadcast.
You're a swinger, a good guy from Yolita BMR. And here's Luai Luai, a number two on the Good Guy Swinging Survey. The King's been working it on out. Frank Stickle in the news is next.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson, at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.